Lansbury paid us a visit and discussed the role that she created in Sweeney Todd. Here to talk with Fresh Air's Danny Miller is George Hearn, now starring opposite Angela Lansbury in the title role of Sweeney Todd. Danny?
Thank you, Terry. The man we're about to meet on Fresh Air gives one of the most gripping stage performances imaginable. My guest is George Hearn, who plays the title role in Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street. Off the stage, out of costume, he looks to be a warm and friendly person. Not the white-faced embodiment of rage and pain, with a touch of charm and more than a touch of insanity that he brings to his stage portrayal. He is in Philadelphia, co-starring with Angela Lansbury in the Tony Award-winning Stephen Sondheim musical, now at the Schubert Theater through January 3rd. Let me tell you a little bit about the show. Set in 19th century London, the musical is about a barber, Sweeney Todd, who returns to London to take revenge on a wicked judge who 15 years before destroyed Sweeney's life by raping his wife and sending Sweeney into exile. Sweeney teams up with Mrs. Lovett, the owner of a meat pie shop played by Angela Lansbury, who has an entrepreneurial flair and a natural attraction to Sweeney. He prepares his revenge on the judge by practicing on the rest of the world. Those who enter his barbershop for a cut and a shave also get their throats slashed. Times are rough, and the ambitious Mrs. Lovett turns the worst pies in London into the best pies by incorporating Sweeney's victims into her recipes. It is this gruesome aspect of the show which has probably gotten the most attention, but the gruesomeness in Sweeney Todd is secondary to the brilliant score and libretto by Stephen Sondheim, the performances by George Hearn, Angela Lansbury, and the rest of the cast, and the gripping expression of rage, comic horror, but also love, which shine in the production. George Hearn has appeared on Broadway as Sweeney Todd and has been in Philadelphia before, opposite Liv Ullmann in I Remember Mama. He was nominated for a Tony Award for his portrayal of Kurt Mueller in Lillian Hellman's Watch on the Rhine. He's appeared in several productions for the New York Shakespeare Festival and in regional theater, including Bucks County Regional Theater. George Hearn has also been seen in several television movies and on PBS in The Addams Chronicles, The Best of Families, and the films Sea Marks and It's the Willingness. Before we meet George Hearn, let's listen to an excerpt from the soundtrack recording of Sweeney Todd with Len Carew playing the role of Sweeney. The name of this selection is No Place Like London, and it occurs during the beginning of the show as Sweeney and a sailor friend arrive in London.
Mr. Todd,
you are young. Life has been kind to you. You will learn. So, Anthony, it is here we go our several ways. Farewell. I shall not soon forget the good ship Bountiful, nor the young man who saved my life.
To the devil with you!
Pardon me, sir, but there's no need to fear the likes of her. She was only a half-crazed beggar woman. London's full of them.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it, and its morals aren't worth what a pig could spit, and it goes by the name of London. At the top of the hole sit the privileged few, making mock of the vermin in the lower sew, turning beauty into filth and greed. I, too, have sailed the world and seen its wonders, for the cruelty of men is as wondrous as Peru, but there's no place like London. Was a barber and his wife, and she was beautiful. A foolish barber and his wife, she was his reason and his life, and she was beautiful, and she was virtuous, and he was naive. There was another man who saw that she was beautiful, a pious vulture of the law, who with a gesture of his claw removed the barber from his plate. Then there was nothing but to wait, and she would fall, so soft, so young, so lost, and oh, so beautiful.
The lady, sir, did she succumb?
Oh, that was many years ago. I doubt if anyone would know. Now leave me, Antony. I beg of you. There's somewhere I must go. Something I must find out now and alone.
So long, then. Mr. Tom.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it.
Len Carreyrou singing No Place Like London from the original cast version of Sweeney Todd. I'm joined in the studio by George Hearn, who's in Philadelphia, performing the title role, Sweeney Todd, at the Schubert Theater. Welcome to Fresh Air, George, and I have to tell you how much I enjoyed your performance.
Thank you, Dan.
In this show.
Thank you.
Sweeney Todd is the type of guy that, when I first thought about it, I figured, well, I don't know if I'd really want to meet him, the character. But on the other hand, there are very many likable and charismatic things about Sweeney Todd. Could you describe the character to us? Tell us a little bit of what he's about.
Well, my feelings about him that redeem the show from its bloodiness in some way is the fact that he's an extremely passionate man, and he has a great love for a woman. And being a romantic myself, I guess that in some way exonerates him. He's also a man caught in a political, sociological trap, who tries many other things before he turns to violence, then tries violence on a modest scale, and even failing at that, then he goes psychopathic and tries violence on a larger scale. But there's nothing inhuman about the progress. The way he gets there is, he's not a crazy, cruel man from the beginning. I think that his love, his frustrated love, is what turns him to violence.
Can you identify parts of George Hearn in the Sweeney Todd character?
Surely. I'm a good friend of Colleen Dewhurst's, and she once said to me, in rehearsal, I find that lady, and then I put all the other ladies in me to sleep. And I think I found parts of me that allow me to do a part like Sweeney Todd, and then I put the other parts of me to sleep. One is a great passionate capacity for love. I think I'm being Irish and a bit crazy myself, have that. The other is a social indignation that I think this piece talks a great deal about, the Industrial Revolution's damage to human beings, that they become pieces of machinery for the economic structure, and that they turn in this way. And I think that sort of sense of social indignation, which Sondheim and Prince both intended to be in this, but not in a preachy way, they are in this. And Hal Prince told me, he said, I couldn't have done this except for two or three lines, those above will serve those down below, that rather grisly reference. But that there is social commentary, and it's a passionate part of this piece.
How does the London setting evoke some of the social commentary?
Well, it's a large iron foundry. They actually, in the New York company, bought an iron foundry out on Long Island and put it onto this. It was the set. So we had a huge stage there, much larger at the Eurus than, of course, at the Schubert here, which is a wonderful theater to play in, by the way. And in fact, going on about the set a bit more, it's a huge set that suggests the crushing power of work, factory working. There's one of the signals in the play is a factory whistle just shrieking at you. All of this suggesting the dehumanizing effects of factory life. So the set made that statement without the writer having to make the statement. That social statement was there all the time. Then, on the other hand, Stephen Sondheim said to me that he had written a chamber opera, which I believe it is in some ways, in many ways. It's a small piece in some ways, in a very large frame, and that large frame made the social comment. The Iron Foundry was so large going into the Eurus Theater that they were working on a hotel next door, and the Iron Workers Union came over and said, no, you shouldn't be doing this. This is our job. Had a union dispute over it. It's a huge, powerful set.
The role that you play is very demanding. Much of the time, you really are in a rage, storming up and down the stage. Your voice is at quite a volume frequently, and it's a very passionate role and character that's on stage. For this type of demanding role, do you think that it's necessary to have any sympathy for the character, or can somebody just through an extreme amount of craft and skill and acting ability be able to play a good Sweeney without having some sympathy for the character?
Well, it's very similar to playing, say, Richard III or the Scottish chief, or a lot of parts. Some of the great classics of the theater, of course, are people who, at least in the course of the play, do terrible, terrible things. I think what you find is the inside of that person that who is then led down a primrose path into... that it has to be something, it seems to me, that's rooted in general human nature, that any one of us might, under these circumstances, do this thing. You and I were talking earlier about Westerns and how the setup in a Western is. Henry Fonda, or somebody with a very lovely image as a person. In the traditional Westerns, you saw the character man get beat up by the villain, and maybe a lady or two get beat up just enough to make us furious, so that then the hero can go about doing his work, which might be dreadfully violent normally. But I think that's universally acceptable, that we could say, if this were done to me, if Sweeney, for example, being sent off 15 years to a penal colony in Australia, and then his wife being raped by the judge who sent him off, that this man, like the Count of Monte Cristo, has the right to do an awful lot when he comes back. He comes back for simple revenge on that judge and that beadle sheriff, and then, frustrated in that, flips into a psychopathic murderer.
Right. The beginning of the play, of the musical, shows Sweeney Todd as somebody you can easily sympathize with.
Seems to me.
Sympathize with the revenge, but it does get psychopathic. How does your portrayal of Sweeney Todd change throughout the show to give us a vision of somebody who's more than just seeking revenge, but who's really gone a little bit mad?
Well, that's Stephen Sondheim, his vision of it, it seems to me, as he has described it to me too, and I hope to get it, is to show the vulnerability of the man and the humanity, that he's He's not a monster at the beginning of the play. What I think Stephen tried to do is delineate a psychopathic breakdown. And a lot of people, this is very in cold blood. There's a lot of reportage going on, and this trying to understand the murdering mind is not a new thing. And the new book by Norman Mailer, The Executioner's Song, a study of Gary Gilmore. This is a similar exploration, if you want to, you know, take it on that level. It's also got marvelous humor and black humor, but it's very funny. It's a delightful piece. It's brilliantly put together. I think it is a great love story also. And this is another aspect of Stephen Sondheim's coaching with me, is that as long as you know that the man desperately loved this woman and was 15 years away from her and then saw her all but destroyed by this man, then love becomes, ironically, of course, the trigger for this desperate killing.
Well, to make that work, you have to maintain the sympathies of the audience and hold these different things, the psychopathic personality, the element of love. You have to hold these in balance with each other. How do you do that? How do you keep the sympathy of the audience as you're slicing people's throats and doing horrible things?
Well, one of the things is, again, it written into the music. I think it often, from my knowledge of it, psychopathic behavior is not always visible. For me in plays, for example, if Iago is an obvious villain, then Othello becomes a fool. If Claudius is an obvious villain, then Hamlet becomes a weak, foolish. If Sweeney Todd is just grisly and monstrous, nobody you get your shave down the street with somebody a little more attractive. You know, I think that you have to play that the man is extremely pleasant on the surface. That's the psychopathic part of it. Is Stephen has written a beautiful love song to his memory of his daughter. Sweeney's singing this beautiful love song while he's killing, as he kills people. I think it makes a good sense dramatically, and I think it makes good sense. Stephen has tried to delineate mental breakdown.
What's your sense of what the audience is reacting to? Is it the love story? Is it the anger that Sweeney's expressing? Is it the blood?
I think they're pulled back and forth throughout the play. I think that often when we played this for young high school children who will vocalize what older people are feeling but not vocalize, that they cheered when I finally killed the judge, finally slit his throat. Now, cheering for the slitting of a throat doesn't sound like a very attractive thing, but somehow it's in the human heart. It's an exploration of this aspect of human nature that's involved in the play. So that's one part. The revenge story gets told. I think there's a part when of the play that is about, will he get his revenge? Another part is the love story, when we find out finally that he has finally killed the woman who he loved all his life. There's a great Greek catharsis, it seems to me, as in the Bacchae. I mean, it's an enormous piece of theater. There's a great piece of theater, I think.
Well, you've performed Sweeney Todd in three cities, New York, Washington, and now Philadelphia. What do reviewers seem to pick up on in terms of, you know, there's a love story, there's a...
Well, as you were suggesting, the revenge part seems to be the thing generally mentioned. The obvious surface of the play gets mentioned. In a review, of course, there's a limited space, and so in trying to speak about the performers and the original concept and so forth, I found that nobody's been able to delve very deeply into the story in a review.
Has it gotten many bad reviews? Everything I've seen has been pretty glowing, but I was wondering.
It's all been good. I think originally in New York there were some people who didn't like it, who just found the subject matter unpalatable, and there are people for whom it's strong medicine. I think that a lot of people who are afraid and stay away from it for that reason might be charmed if they came, though. My own mother came. My mother can't stand violence, and she came and saw it. Then she came back seven more times and saw it. Of course, it was her son doing it, but she overcame her edginess about the subject matter, which isn't all that grisly. You and I were talking earlier. I think stage violence is not as horrific for modern theater goer because of the... clarity of
cinematic violence, right?
Violence. I mean, it's so vivid. This is clearly a stage device. although they're good stage devices and quite chilling when one gets drawn into them, I don't think it's a horrendously violent piece.
One of the devices is as you slit people's throats, there's a great spray of blood, and it's very effective. Can you tell us a little bit about the technique involved? And what the secrets of the trade are with getting the stage?
The razor itself. The razors have a hollow handle, and there's an air capsule, and like you'd have in a CO2 air pistol, and then a stage blood capsule. I press a button, and in fact don't even get anywhere near anybody's throat. It's about 4 inches away from the throat, and then it splatters real bad.
Have you ever had any misfires? So in the middle of the show, all of a sudden, perhaps your jacket gets very red, or whatever you get the razor?
Sometimes the technical term is bleed. The razors bleed a little. That is that the blood drips out of the razor before. Then I keep it behind my back as long as I can and make it real quick. Try not to let the audience see that it's already red.
Well, let's hear a song in the score of Sweeney Todd, which is about the razors, except they're more than just the tools of the barber's trade. They're friends. In fact, the name of the song is Friends, which Sweeney Todd sings to his razors as, I guess, at about the point he starts to really crystallize his plans for revenge. Is there anything you'd like to say about the song before we hear it?
Well, once when I was in New York, doing New York, we tried to describe the play on a show, and Stephen said, the next time you're asked what the show is about, say it's about a woman who loves a man and a man who loves his razors. The razors are his instrument of revenge, and he sees them for the first time in 15 years and realizes that he has a power. There is a weapon.
But it's a love song, too.
It's a love song to a razor.
Well, let's hear it from the original cast album of Sweeney Todd, which has words and music by Stephen Sondheim. This is Len Carreyrou performing a song called Friend.
So it is you, Benjamin Barker. Their mantles is chased silver, ain't they?
Silver, yes. These are my friends. See how they glisten. See this one shine. How he smiles in the light. My friend, my faithful friend. Speak to me, friend. Whisper, I'll listen. I know you've been locked out of sight all these years. Like me, my friend. Well, I've come home.
At last, my arm is complete again. and laughed when he often smiled.
He'd seen how civilized men behave. He never forgot and he never forgave.
Masini, Masini Todd,
the demon barber of Fleet Street.
From the soundtrack recording of Sweeney Todd, that was a song called Friends. My guest is George Hearn, who is in Philadelphia at the Schubert Theater, playing the title role of Sweeney Todd, which is, of course, written by Stephen Sondheim. The score is a difficult one. It has many unusual parts where the melody that you have to sing, or Angela Lansbury, who's also in the show, has to sing, doesn't always go with the harmony. It's very dissonant. There are lots of unusual sounds. What are some of the unusual things to you about the score and some of the difficult parts of the score?
Well, it's a very complicated. It is an opera. You know, these people have haggled about what it is, and it's unnecessary. You know, the term musical comedy is so deceptive. I don't know why we've clung to it all these years. Because certainly, Carousel was not even a musical comedy, but we. And then people say, well, is this an opera? Well, I think it's for pedagogues to worry about or something. I don't think it really matters. It's a piece that cuts out its own territory, which is enormous. It is an opera. It's quite complicated musically.
Is it more difficult than most operas? Not necessarily technically, but just in terms of the type of interpretation you have to bring
to it? It's very hard. I sang opera quite a few years ago. I studied opera to sing opera. And an opera singer doesn't sing eight times a week, and we do this eight times a week, for one thing, which is very, very tiring. An opera singer doesn't speak. It's a different use of the voice, and there's plenty of speaking in this also. It's very hard to do, and both Angela and I, in fact, the whole cast has to marshal their physical strength very carefully. We live a fairly lean lifestyle. After the show, we'd generally go out, and the company's rather convivial, and we'd have a drink or two, and then are asleep by two, usually, and sleep well into the day.
Is there, just to deviate for a moment, is there much of a span of lifestyles in the cast in terms of how calm or how relatively excited people get? You know, do people tend to, some people tend to party a lot, on the other hand, others go home. And
we have to be a little careful with the partying. It's a very gregarious group, I think, all together. We have to make ourselves break off and go to bed. It's in my nature. I do love drink, and this is, people have jokingly said, that you may be the only man that Sweeney Todd makes to live longer. Because I've had to cut back on a lot of things, but I enjoy it. I love this piece so enormously, and the fear of going out there and doing it less than the best I can do it is enough to keep me easily self-disciplining. Musically, it's I suppose the hardest parts are the parts that stretch the range of my voice the most. They're the hardest for me. The epiphany. Number where he goes crazy, and Stephen has written there some high G's, open G's. They're hard for a baritone, but he's pushing everybody to the limits of their skills. Everybody in the company, I think, everybody in the piece. So we do have to be careful.
Did he give you any coaching? Did you work with him at the piano or anything like that?
Not much. Mostly it was about the dramatic values, but he had very specific ideas about the play. His notes were wonderful. They were very small and meticulous.
Yeah, what notes. Type of feedback would he give you?
Hal Prince gave rather large, helping you draw the line through the play. If something had gone too early or too late in the plotting, he would help. But Stephen was wonderfully meticulous about the details, which he wrote very specific little things, and he wants them exactly right.
That's evident in the language of the libretto and how that times in with the music, and then if you've seen the play, how the action and the stage direction fits in very, very closely with the words. What are your favorite parts of the show?
I love the entire thing. I do love the hardest part, the center of the difficulty of the play for me is the end of Act One, from Pretty Women, when he almost gets to kill the judge, epiphany that I mentioned earlier, where he goes crazy, goes psychopathic, and Try a Little Priest, the first idea of baking people into pies, Mrs. Lovett first suggests it, which is fun.
Yeah, a light bulb goes on in really, the stage when you get the idea.
Isn't she something too? Angela, she's wonderful to work with. One of the most generous, open people I've ever known, certainly on a stage too. Wonderful.
Do you feel that your interpretation of Sweeney would be any different if it wasn't Angela Lansbury that you were working with most of the time?
Well, I tried to define this when I did it earlier. I did it with Dorothy Loudon in New York when Angela and Lynn were replaced by us. I think my own temperament and my own ideas about the show were going in that direction already. But doing it, continuing now to do it and doing it with Angela, we've certainly found other values than I had found before. Angela's sense of humor is infectious and it's irresistible, and it's extremely important in the play, because it's the leavening that makes this the dough rise. It makes this play go. I think there's an enormous amount of black humor in it that's very, very funny, and Angela is just a master at it, and it brings it out in me, and we have a great playful time.
Is there anything frightening about performing Sweeney Todd to you? I mean, are there aspects of Sweeney Todd as you can have sympathy for somebody who, out of what seems like a normal sense of revenge, all of a sudden, you know, well, not all of a sudden, but does gradually turn into a psychopath, and you can understand that transition also. Does that disturb you, that you can sympathize with that? Is that at all frightening, that you might recognize that in yourself?
I thought it would be. I have a very low tolerance for terror in movies.
And, right.
As a child, I hid under the seat when I was a little baby. When I saw the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, when the Queen turned in the crone, I have no capacity for violence at all. It's very strange, though, that being in it, it doesn't affect me that way. For one thing, I know how, say, the razors work. I know that that I'm not really killing anybody. It doesn't create an image in my mind. I'm inside the feelings of the character, and which, as I've said to you earlier, I tried to justify for myself in human terms that he's doing something that we might all do, and I think once you do that, then it has a different impact. I asked Len and I asked Angela earlier if they had, when I first was going into it, did you have bad dreams as a result of playing in this? And I had done The Scottish Lord and a bunch of other plays in which there a lot of bloodshed. They said no. And in fact, I haven't found that true either. If anything, it seems to be that it I express it, get it out.
Maybe. Yeah. How about during the day, before the show, as you're walking on the street or something, and you might see some characters that might be a little intimidating or frightening? Is there any sense of change in how you might empathize with just other people in the world after confronting a person like Sweeney Todd yourself?
Well, it is an exploration of madness, and I think any time you do that, you widen your own tolerance of at least the human situation. I'm not meaning that you want to encourage such people to attack you or anybody else, but I mean, I look at life differently since doing Sweeney. Yes.
How did you first get interested in the role? When did you first run across Sweeney Todd?
I was here in Philadelphia doing pre-Broadway of I Remember Mama, and Len Carew, who's a friend of mine, and we have the same agent, as a matter of fact, was doing in New York. Was doing this. I didn't get to see it because I Remember Mama ran through the summer. We had the same schedule. I never got to see Sweeney Todd. Then I went right into Watch on the Rhine up at the Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, then came into New York. So I never, until I knew I was going to play it, I didn't see Sweeney.
You did see Len Carew perform.
Then I saw Len and Angela do it once, yes.
You know, there's always the decision to make when you're going to assume a role that that somebody's already had, of whether you want to watch your predecessor or not, or whether maybe you don't want to be influenced by his performance at all. What were your feelings when you saw the show that first time about how much you might want to pick up from his portrayal?
Well, I said to Dorothy Loudon, and I were going at the same time, I said, I think there has to be a new Tony Award called The Most Difficult Act to Follow, because I was stunned by both of them and by the piece, stunned. And in fact, I only saw it once and could have seen it more, and didn't want to because I didn't want to carry over any more of that than I didn't want to imitate any. On the other hand, I didn't want to not imitate because that is a trap too, I think. I think that the part is enormous, and any two actors playing it will come up with similar line readings, interpretations of certain moments, because, as I said, it's very specifically written by Mr. Sondheim. And the differences in temperament and, say, vocal quality between Len and me made an enormous difference in, you know, just our differences as people, made differences in the characterization. So I never tried not to do Len, I never tried to do him. So I think I found my own way. And I must say, you had asked me earlier, too, if Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim in any way nudged us into repetition. They certainly didn't. They were just wonderful, left us a completely open palette. Of course, fulfilling the play, I don't mean to do anything we wanted to, but there was no encouragement to repeat them at all. And I guess that's one of the advantages of going in a large part, in a large production, is that they give you that space, and it was wonderful.
How has the Sweeney Todd character evolved since you've been doing Sweeney?
I may have gotten further into the aspect of Sweeney as a lover, a man who loved a woman very deeply. I started out, you can shout your way right through this role because it's about a man who's caught in a trap and has, heaven knows, the right to scream a lot. It's, if you do that, I think it's it becomes monochromatic and a bit dull. So again, Sondheim would hold me back and say,
Shade.
Find all the colors you can. And there are many, many colors because it's a huge, huge part.
At the end of a night's performance, I'm sure there are some things in particular which you look back to that you just performed as a way of evaluating how good that show was. Can you share some of those parts with us? What do you look at, or what about your technique or your craft do you evaluate when you say to yourself, "Did I do my best tonight?"
Well, first of all, vocally, I think was my voice clear? Was it pleasant to listen to? There's a problem with it because I do shout a lot in the play, and there's a lot of growling.
Is there a lot of honey and tea?
No, I've knock on wood, not had any trouble yet vocally. I got very tired just a few nights ago and had to just take the show off last night, as a matter of fact, because I felt I was getting behind. It's such a difficult part that if you get behind physically, I think it would just grind you to a powder, and. So I've taken good care of myself. But vocally, first of all, did I sing well? You know, were the moments that I touched on as vivid as, you know, as I could make them, particularly the ending of the play, which is again about the love story, and the end of Act Two, which is the most difficult singing part, the madness. It's holding it all together. If I can hold it together and still sing well, then I feel I've done it. It's very different every night, too.
Is there much feedback offered between cast members about something that, you could really see very close up as you're standing next to somebody on the stage about each person's performance? Do members of a cast share that type of thing with others, or is that regarded as not something?
It's sacred territory. I don't think that actors often give notes to each other about, hardly ever. Except reinforcing, gee, you're saying that awfully well tonight. The other thing is tricky. And generally, the good manners of the theater is if you have one, you go to the stage manager, and then he gives the note to that person.
Have there been any changes in the show itself in terms of numbers being cut or adapting to a new theater or reevaluating the musical, not just an interpretation, but, you know, changing the show at all?
Well, the set's smaller, of course, for one thing, and that's, as many people have pointed out, all to the good, they think. The focus is better, in a way, because it's a small, as I said, chamber opera, among other things, and some people have preferred it here to that large proscenium we had in the Eurus in New York. And I think, I love this theater, I love the Schubert, And the focus here is very good. We're playing, to 1,800 people as opposed to, well, we're in Washington, quite a few more. And that's pleasant, too. That's fun because for us we can do smaller things and they read, they tell, you know. And it's nice doing it in different size houses because the show is different in each house.
Installing the set is no small task either because you have metal walkways in the set that go up and down and huge covers in the back of the set that slide up and down. It's pretty ambitious.
It's very heavy. It takes about 4 days to put it in. Night and day. The men work night and day to get it in.
Are there TV commercials which show in these cities?
Yes.
Could you tell us about what they pick for the TV commercial to entice people to see Sweeney Todd?
Well, we took a piece of the end of Act One called Little Priest, Have a Little Priest. We took just the ending of that song. Have charity towards the world, my pet. We'll take the customers that we can get. We'll not discriminate great from small. No, we'll serve anyone, meaning anyone, and to anyone at all. And just that part. And Angela and I made this commercial quite a while back. And it doesn't really happen that way in the show, but it shows the show.
Well, after seeing yourself, I guess, on videotape, could you see Sweeney Todd as a movie?
Yes. It had better be done very well. Of course, this is true of any musical. They're awful hard to do, aren't they? They're usually not done that well. But if somebody with a real passion for it, one of the really great filmmakers, fell in love with the idea, I think it would be a stunning thing.
I tell you, I had, in seeing the musical, I had pretty good seats, sitting close up, and then I had opera glasses with me. So it was like I could take a close-up of you or Angela Lansbury or other members of the cast and really see your expressions very close up. And it, you know, it really would have worked for me in a movie in terms of close-ups. It wasn't like sometimes you see on stage something that looks okay, looks normal from the back of the auditorium, but if you see it with binoculars and things seem very overblown. But even though expressions, facial expressions and motions were very intense, it still worked very close up. Are you aware of how you're using your face or these type of motions? Is that something that's just integrated in the character? Or are you specifically aware of, you know, you do something with your face or use your body in some way?
Well, as an actor, my own technique has been that I'm mostly in my voice and in words. And I very seldom think of what I've done, except now that I've done it I did it 4 months in New York and now 2 months on the road, I'm sure that I have some computerized inner feeling about what I'm doing physically. But mostly I've felt that I'm a vacuum at the center of my perceptions of things. As an actor, I very seldom know that I've made this or that gesture. It's the inner process that I think an actor memorizes, refines, works on. And as I say, in my case, for example, a dancer or a mime would work quite differently. They would be quite aware of that, I'm sure, if they were also an actor. But being a singer, and I love words a lot, I think that basically I see the part through the words, through the language.
It's very similar to if you were to ask a musician that improvises, a jazz musician, for instance, to say, well, were you aware of how you were manipulating the notes or what you were doing? And frequently they'll say, no, I mean, I have a general sense of my approach to playing and so forth, but, you know, I'm not really, I'm sort of on a different way of seeing things and being able to verbalize what I had just said. Are there parts that you consciously try to change, or is there anything you do to not get into a groove of repeating something and perhaps getting stale in the role?
It's amazing that the play is a very fine barometer of your own inner life. And I find that I don't have to do much conscious, that is intellectual, changing of attitude. The difference between yesterday and today is sufficient that frequently you're surprised by a whole different line reading, a whole different approach to a moment. I mean, within a structure, within a framework. And on the really great nights, which happen maybe once a month if you're lucky, you are acted. You are acted almost like by an external force. And I'm not a highly mystical person, but I think that This is true of the arts in general, that when you're really, it's not a simple thing like inspiration, but often when you've really done your work, if you're working very hard, then some night your intuition allows something else to happen. It's almost effortless. It's a wonderful feeling. You come off, you hardly know you've put out any physical effort at all.
When that happens, and perhaps if it's, I'm wondering, like, for instance, if it would happen with one of the duets you do with Mrs. Lovett, with Angela Lansbury, is that a surprise for her too, or is it a private awareness of something?
It's funny, we usually know. We usually come off and say, wasn't that fascinating? Did you feel what I felt? Almost always it's together, particularly, say, in a duet. But even in the larger pieces, frequently that's the sensation that is shared.
Well, in a touring cast, as you visit different cities, I'm sure that there's a lot of hanging out that the cast does with each other. Have there evolved any Sweeney Todd jokes or sort of in jokes of the company?
Oh, well, we've got a lot of versions of it. As you said earlier, you do that with something you respect a great deal, because we do respect this piece enormously. But there's a playfulness about it. And Kenny Jennings, who's a wonderful Toby in this play, who kills me at the end, is shorter than I by a bit, and he wanted on the road, he was going to do this part and call it Weenie Todd. We have a lot of that sort of teasing. We have a Yiddish version, a black version of Sweeney that in our minds we joke around with from time to time. But you have to be careful.
Listen, if you care to share any of the dialogue from any of the ethnic versions, feel free.
You have to be careful with it, though, because you can talk yourself into it, and then you go out to do it one night and you blurt out.
And you might say, yes, and Mr. Todd, or something terrible
like
that. That's
right. It's got to be kosher, it's green, instead of, yes.
Well, this is correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that this would be your first extremely big role, the one that's getting a lot of national attention, or certainly the biggest role in your career so far. What type of career impact does doing Sweeney Todd have for you?
Well, I've done a lot of regional rep and a lot of Shakespeare and a lot of classics. And I haven't sung for a long time. I sang again in I Remember Mama. And it's given me that dimension. It's also a very visible piece. You know, I mean, it's a very famous piece, and it's a very difficult role. It's lifted my career up enormously. But it kind of came stair-step-wise, and as I say, I've done, you know, 20 years of it. I've done about 100 plays now. So it won't be a case of too much too soon. I feel it's just a very graceful timing that I've been very privileged and very lucky. Because if you go much longer, a kind of bitterness starts to set in. I'm 46 now, and I notice that if an actor doesn't get some kind of recognition that they're special in some way, it's true of all of life, not just acting, that after putting X number of years in it, you begin to get bitter. I didn't even approach that point about the theater. And yet I do feel that I have, in 20 years and 100 plays, that I've developed a technique both for personal survival in a difficult business and a stage technique. So it feels like an honest moment to me, and I'm very lucky to have it.
When now you're very much at the height, I would think, of performing Sweeney Todd, is this a time when you're starting to get many offers for other shows?
Well, Angela and I are going to do this until next August, so there's nothing really possible to talk about in specific terms. There are some things in the fire, though. I hope we're going to be in L.A. for a while at the end of this, and I'd like to do some film.
Anything in particular that did?
Not at the moment. I've done a few. I've done a few for public radio, for public television, the Theater in America series, did C-Marks, and loved. I loved that filming process. I was also in Kramer versus Kramer and got cut out on the floor, had a whole lot of scenes, and had six or seven scenes. And they cut the character right out.
Can you tell us a little bit of who the Kramer character was?
He was called the Saturday Father, and he was a professional man in New York that Dustin Hoffman would run into out in the park or in the museum, and he'd say, oh, you'll get used to this. You take the kid out every Saturday. And he was doing his obligatory parental stint, and Hoffman kept eyeing him and seeing that this was the father he did not want to turn into. And then I would come rushing across and wave at him like, hey, and he'd turn and run the other way. It was that kind of a marvelous kind of character. But they found out, obviously, that they didn't need that character to make the statement. They cut it all out. Too bad for me, but it was a great piece.
Have you been approached by any razor blade companies to do endorsements?
Not a one. Although I do shave with a straight razor.
Well, that might yet come your way. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming to Fresh Air. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
My guest has been George Hearn, and he is in Philadelphia performing the title role in Sweeney Todd, the musical by Stephen Sondheim, which is also starring Angela Lansbury in the role of Mrs. Lovett. And Sweeney Todd is now playing at the Schubert Theater through January 3rd. Thanks again for coming to Fresh Air, George. And we're going to hear the epilogue from Sweeney Todd. Is there anything you'd like to say to describe about the epilogue before we hear it, to discuss the setting that just preceded that, or shall we leave that for the audiences to see?
Leave it for them to see, I think. Come and see it, though.
Let's hear the epilogue from Sweeney Todd.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd.
He shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again.
He trod a path that few have trod.
Tis Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
He kept a shop in London town of fancy clients and good renown.
And what if none of their souls were saved? They went to their maker impeccably shaved.
My Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
The epilogue of Sweeney Todd from the original cast recording. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Just speaking with George Hearn was WUHY's Danny Miller. It's a minute after 3 o'clock, and this is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Well, at 3:30 today, Bill Van Wert will be with us, and he'll be talking about the film Gloria, which stars Gina Rowlands and is directed by John Cassavetes. And at 4 o'clock, my guest will be Stanley Kaufman, and you may be familiar with his reviews. Since 1958, he's been the film reviewer for The New Republic. He's also written about theater for The New Republic and for Saturday Review. He has two books that have been published during 1980. One of them is an anthology of his film reviews and film essays, and the other is called Albums of Early Life, and it's the first volume of his memoirs. So we'll be talking about both those books when he joins us at 4. Every Tuesday on Fresh Air at 3:30, we feature Jazz Revisited, which is a survey of recorded jazz from 1917 to 1947, hosted by Hazen Schumacher. But this Tuesday, if you were listening, you heard that we had a special program with Francis Davis about the music of John Lennon, so we did preempt Jazz Revisited on Tuesday. We rescheduled it for today, and we have Jazz Revisited standing by now. The subject today is some of the extended recordings made by Count Basie, Louis Armstrong, and Jazz at the Philharmonic. This is Jazz Revisited.
Okay, that's Louis Armstrong doing a little medley, starting out with When You're Smiling. We're going to play that and a couple others on today's program, Extended Recordings.
Jazz Revisited. Revisited, a review of the first three decades of recorded American jazz, 1917 to 1947, the artists and their music, a program produced at the University of Michigan. Here is your host, Hazen Schumacher.
Today we're going to play some of those longer-than-usual recordings from the 78 era, when it was, for example, in the first one is a 78 RPM, a 10-inch, and if you wanted anything longer than three and a half minutes, you had to go to two sides, and in this case, this is just what the Count Basie Orchestra did. It's kind of a funny, obscure recording. It's called The World is Mad, and it's on two sides. Kind of opens up like a 1 o'clock jump, but it's in a marvelous period in the Basie band. I don't know that this record ever came out on LP, although it was, right at the time it was recorded, also issued on an English label, so the English knew at that time how good this was. But anyway, it's the Count Basie band at its swinging best. It's two sides of a 10-inch, as I said, and we've put the two of them together to make it sound as near consecutive as possible. You've got Basie soloing on piano with that all that marvelous all-American rhythm section, and you hear the guitar, even on this scratchy 78, the guitar and the bass and the drums coming through. Lester Young is on tenor sax, although there are two tenor sax here, and maybe one of them is Buddy Tate. Then trombone, probably Dickie Wells, and there's even a little bass solo on here by Walter Page, and then a relatively rare drum solo by Joe Jones. But it's the Basie band at its height in this period, anyway. Count Basie and his orchestra, The World is Mad, 1 and 2, August 1940. ¶¶